Hello, everyone. Welcome back to episode 209 of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the solo careers of Paul McCartney. I'm Tom Hunyadi. You may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast. And as always, I'm joined by my friend, my partner, my backwards traveler, the other leg. He is Andy Nichols. Andy, my friend, what's going on?
Hey, Thomas. Good to see you again and really happy to have a guest back on the show that hasn't been on our show in quite a while.
Well, a little while. I think this is his fourth appearance on the show, and we really appreciate him taking the time out of his busy schedule, because as you can see, we've got the solid state book, we've got Phantom in the Beatles, we've got the two George Martin volume series of on George Martin, we got the Beatles Encyclopedia, we got John Lennon 1980, we got
everything.
George Harrison and Eric Clapton. And actually that's the wrong book, sorry. But anyways, this man has been busy. He's got the new book, the very, very much anticipated book on Mel Evans. It's Living the Beatles Legend, The Untold Story of Mel Evans. And here is Ken Womack. Ken, thank you for coming back on. And I know it's crazy right now. It has to be crazy. You know, you're working a lot, and we really appreciate you taking the time out.
Well, thanks, fellas, and I appreciate all those walks down memory lane there.
Yeah.
Those are relics from a different age.
Oh, these ones, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But you're done writing this book right now. This first part, the Living the Beatles Legend. It's everything you've had to do with it now is complete. We're just waiting on the book to be released. Correct?
I think that's mostly true. You know, it's the kind of book that we've been tinkering with, making sure we're getting things right. It has a lot of photographs. So, you know, checking and double checking those, as you guys and I have talked about, I guess offline, you know, Mal collected a lot of photos. So we want to make sure we're getting a good sampling of those in this first book in November. So we're almost there, but plenty of stuff left to do.
Yeah. Speaking of photos, you showed the cover, and was there no photo of him with all four, or was that the best cover you thought, or best picture you thought for the cover? I mean, obviously, you know, we don't want the, you know, other camps to get upset to think, oh, he's only took pictures with Paul McCartney here. But talk about the cover picture for a minute.
Sure. So I think it's kind of fitting. Mal, as you guys know, really lionized Paul. Paul was a great hero to him. So I think it makes a lot of sense. They spent arguably the most time together among the five of them. So six, if you count, you know, Neil, as you should.
Right.
So I think it's appropriate, but there are photos of Mal with all the band members. You know, there are several. This one just really struck the team as being the right photo to capture this story at the right time. But there are a few other ones. I think we made the right choice.
Okay.
Yeah. Ken, tell us a little bit of the backstory about why a book on Mal to begin with, and when did that germ of an idea begin for you guys?
Well, it never really began for me. You know, I obviously, like you, I've always been interested in Mal and wanting to unlock some of the mysteries surrounding his story. But having said that, you know, I had no plans to write about him. And then through a mutual friend at the beginning of COVID, Simon Weitzman, whom we all know, Simon connected me with Gary Evans, Mal's son, who's now in his early 60s. And he told me that Gary was interested in talking to me about doing something with Mal's story. And I was intrigued, but I didn't expect to find a lot, to be frank. I figured, you know, 80,000 words or something you could tell the story in. I was very wrong about that. It was at the beginning of COVID. So I met Gary over Zoom, and he and his wife mailed the materials here to New Jersey. And I just immediately, I was staggered by what I was seeing. I'd never seen so many of these photographs before, you know, and we're all so attuned to the photographs that exist in Beetle World that it really hits you when you're seeing something new. And then also the diaries I found to be entertaining. It's a much more tragic story than I think I knew before. So that was part of the discovery. But the germ of the idea really was Gary Evans. And I've got to salute him because, you know, we all know that his father was living with another woman when he died. And Gary has never put any stipulations on what I can write or talk about. And it's really been a warts and all experience. I mean, Mal certainly had his warts. So we're not really holding anything back about his story. But it's just one of these tales that I'll quote my father, because you can't have a better reader than your own father. Right. He said that when he read it the first time, he just kept hoping it would end differently. You know, like the Titanic, you know, come on, turn early, you know, you actually don't have to hit the iceberg. You could, you know. But I think now hits the iceberg every time.
It's unfortunate. You've had help with this book too, because if I remember correctly, the people at Abcor were getting ready to produce a Mal Evans book as well, correct?
Right. There's a fellow named Peter Hicks, Canadian writer and researcher, and he'd been studying Mal for quite some time. And he has been just invaluable in providing me with some leads, knowing some of the answers I needed, and having them really at the ready. So he saved lots of time. So he's certainly been helpful. You know, I mean, the most helpful thing, and I mean, nothing against Peter here, but the most helpful thing is Mal's diary, you know, and the material that were found in all of these boxes that contained all of Mal's earthly goods, his effects. And, you know, he kept everything. So, you know, when I wanted to find out who so-and-so was who did this thing, usually I just go into Mal's box and there it was, you know, and, in one case, there was almost a 50-year-old phone number that still worked, you know.
Wow.
So it's kind of been the opposite of a lot of my projects, where trying to create story and narrative can be really difficult, right? You know, trying to find new interviews and that sort of thing. In this case, it's sort of been right there. It's just a matter of following through. So lots of just fascinating stories. People who I caught in the nick of time. Alan White, for example, was really useful. Yeah. Ken Mansfield, I spent many an hour with him talking about Mal. So a lot of folks like that you know, are no longer with us, who really helped out.
Interesting. Any luck with Paul or Ringo getting current, you know, talking points about Mal for this book?
Well, I mean, naturally, I reached out in case they want to make a comment. You know, nothing's been forthcoming so far, but, you know, their words are all over this book. I mean, they spoke about Mal and spent so much time with him that there's a really solid historical record. And while I would, you know, I'd absolutely love if they wanted to add a comment about Mal, you know, much of what they've said is already, much of what they would say has already been said, and probably better, in the sense that, you know, Mal died nearly 50 years ago, right? So 47 years ago. And, you know, there is nothing more frail than the human memory. And, you know, we watch as, people, you know, advance in age and simply have difficulty, you know, honing in on their stories. So I tend to trust what people say contemporaneously with the events anyway. And I think in this case, we're not missing much. It hasn't been a situation where I've needed someone to comment on something, because, you know, when you have Mal's diaries, which we do, and Mal kept piles of notebooks as well, where he would write his thoughts, you know, those are his contemporaneous thoughts from his perspective. So, you know, I give a lot of credence to that kind of material, you know, because even if perhaps someone else might have a different point of view about something, it's still Mal's point of view that he captured contemporaneously at the moment. And so I, you know, like I said, you have to provide a lot of evidentiary weight to those kind of remarks.
From the time when they were said, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But having said that, you know, this is obviously someone that they loved very much. There are great there, but there is an excellent record from all four of the Beatles about how large Mal loomed in their lives, literally, because he loomed large.
Yeah, and I think we can also owe a debt of gratitude to Peter Jackson, because most people now who have watched Get Back can see, wow, he's the unsung hero of that documentary. So the timing of that project with your book now really is going to give Mal Evans his due credit from the Get Back documentary and now your book coming in November.
Yeah, and the Jackson docuseries really demonstrates how integral Mal was to their working process, right? You know, nobody does it alone, and there's Mal participating in so many different ways. You know, he's the guy who will scrape a meal if people need to eat and not leave the studio. He's the guy who in the middle of the night can go get the guitar strings or help out with word choice ideas, as we saw him do with Long and Winding Road, where Paul turns to him, you know, almost reflexively to ask for his help. So they relied on this guy for so much, and a hammer and an anvil, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, let's start talking a little bit about Mal. Can you give us a little paint us a picture a little bit about his childhood, his upbringing in early years of Mal?
Sure. So Mal's born in 1935. He has a pretty idyllic childhood, a very loving family. He would have three sisters, one a kind of late arrival. During the war, they would spend the war years on the Welsh seaside. His father, in spite of his age, participated in the war and actually was injured. So they rode out much of the war in Wales. And had left their home back in Liverpool. You know, his father was probably the best model in Mal's life. His father was a fiercely hard worker, really had to scrape to make his way in the world. In fact, I don't believe Mal's father ever knew who his own father was with any degree of certainty. So, you know, he really had to pull himself up by his bootstraps and just provided Mal with that kind of really hardy model. You know, the early years are the life of youngsters in Liverpool. They lived in a corpy house, a corporation house, as a lot of folks did. His father worked on the docks, was a dock supervisor in the fruit warehouses. Mal was, you know, the oldest amongst three daughters, along with three daughters. And there was kind of an onus that was on him to make good on his birthright. And indeed, Mal is the first person to finish his education in the history of the family, the first person to get a job, to get a car, to have a mortgage. I mean, he really was a trailblazer in all of those ways. He studied initially in a youth and training program to study telephone engineering, proved to be quite adept at it. Had a job with the General Post Office, the GPO, the British Post Office, there in Liverpool. You know, this was an interesting moment because in the mid-1950s, obviously there's no comparison to the technology of the day that we see now, but Mal was involved in you know, building out trunk lines and thinking through the challenges of how to how to make the telephone exchange more complex, right? So it was an interesting time to be coming along and working in a technical field like that.
Go ahead, Andy.
No, so moving forward to his connection to the you know, the bouncer gig at the Cavern, was his in with Ray McFall, who was the owner of the Cavern at the time, or was it through another means?
No, so you know, it's interesting how that comes about. Mal gets married in 1957 to Lily White, and her family actually is slightly better off, I guess, than Mal Evans is. But you know, he begins to follow a really scripted kind of trajectory. I mentioned it before. He's got the wife, he's got the house, you know, the car. I think his father, the most he ever had was a motorcycle with a sidecar. So Mal is following a certain kind of trajectory. He and Lily are very social. They've got a wide group of friends. It's really after Gary's born in 1961, maybe before, but we don't have exact dates here, but either before or slightly after, sometime in the autumn months of 1961, Mal is out on his lunch break, and he would wander around different parts of town. He loved to explore, and this would be true during the Beatles days too, right? He would explore, and that's when he heard this music coming up from the Cavern. You know, it was a Beatles lunchtime concert, and it just blew him away. And he was excited by rock and roll. He loved Elvis. He loved Elvis so much that he was probably like we are with our friends about the Beatles. He really drove everybody crazy talking about Elvis. By the time there was an Elvis fan club in the early 60s, Mal was a charter member. He would get the newsletter. You know, he did try to learn the guitar for a while. And, you know, he could play it a little bit. He could play at parties. But he was just absolutely excited about rock and roll. And what he heard in that basement was different. And, you know, he made a note and he kept coming back. And he liked being around it. He liked the idea that, you know, he could come on his lunch break. And it was really George Harrison who suggested that Mal hook up with the Cavern as a bouncer. But what that morphed into was working for Brian Epstein as sort of the official bouncer for Brian as he began building his stable very quickly. You know, all of that happened with some motion to it. So really things are set into motion there in late 1961. Mal is besotted and loves the whole thing across 62. But there is a sense that at the beginning of 1963, maybe he's had his fill, you know. It's kind of thankless work, standing outside, you know, on Matthew Street, or being asked, you know, to run across and as he did one late night to get a new coffin amplifier for Paul, you know, the big giant bass amplifier, you know. So he was kind of slowing down a little bit by then. But I think a lot of it is owed to George Harrison. He was Mal's first friend in the Beatles. George would come over and after a show have bacon and eggs with Mal and Lily. Or they would, you know, I believe Mal went over to the Harrison's place a few times, but it was kind of a social thing as much as anything else. And, you know, what's fun about the Beatles story when you're writing about it, and maybe this is why I keep coming back, is, you know, nothing is a foregone conclusion. You have to remember that, you know, these are just people who are friends, right? And it's all a lark. And nobody's really thinking they're going to be the, right, you know, the toppermost of the toppermost.
Yeah. Right. So was he making a living? Was Lily happy with, you know, him, you know, taking part of a group? I mean,
you know, Lily's kind of a rock chick. I mean, she liked it. She liked going to clubs. She liked going dancing. She loved music. She liked the fact that, you know, it was part of her social network too. By the end of 62, when Gary's, you know, deep in his, you know, in his, at the end of his second year, she's quite comfortable going out and spends a lot of time with Mal. It became kind of their social life, whether it was those immersive cruises or, you know, or going to the cavern for the evening. That's just kind of what they did. And Mal liked the extra money, you know, the bouncer money meant that a guy who was already doing pretty well had a little extra, you know.
So Mal definitely came into, so Ken, Mal came into their orbit before Neil did, or the other way around? Was it?
It was the other way around. Neil predated Mal by at least 8 months.
Okay.
At least 7 months. And, you know, they knew Neil from school. You know, Neil was just being a really smart entrepreneur. I'll help you out. You pay me for this and we'll drive the van around. So no, he's definitely first in.
Right.
Mal's coming in. I think Mal may have even been around slightly before Brian, but again,
right.
Mal wasn't keeping a diary then. So
when did he start keeping the diary, Ken?
He started keeping the diary on January 1st, 1963. Every year, his engineering union would send him a diary. And he decided, you know, I'm going to start doing this. But the idea wasn't because I'm going to meet this famous rock band, but because, or rather trace the history of this famous rock band, but rather I'm going to trace the history of Gary. He was using it almost as Gary's baby book in a way. And so when you read through it, there's a lot of wonderful commentary about Gary. So that's when he starts that. And so that's why we have a good sense of when maybe he feels like he's kind of on the other side of this, this turn bouncer / security lark.
Right. Well, that's a good part for him, or a good time for him to start, because they really take off then in 63. I mean, the touring is going crazy. 64, 65, 66. Those years, I mean, those must have been really crazy times for him.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, the timing couldn't have been better. I mean, obviously Mal doesn't know that, but the timing simply couldn't have been better. He's got a lot of things he's weighing in his mind, you know. Mal loved to be the center of attention, so he had his own kinds of aspirations. He was still nursing this big stress because he had not been, he had failed to be conscripted. He'd failed his medical. And so he had a deep love of country that he got from his father and wanted to serve. So he's thinking about, and does for a while, joining the, what we would call the reserves. So there's a lot that those early diary entries reveal about where his head is at, and it's kind of all over the place.
Yeah. Well, didn't that law end like when John and Ringo turned 18, where they had to serve? Didn't he have to serve
national service?
Yeah. So what happened when Mal turned 18, he went with his best friends to go and take their medical exam and move forward. They did, and Mal did, and it was a real source of he hated it because, you know, he's a big hulking guy.
Yeah,
he was an avid bike rider, swimmer. I mean, he could lift a ton. He was just in tremendous shape, and he could not believe how it had all transpired. And he was just it was just one of those things that was under his skin. And he wanted to right that wrong. So, yeah, by the time Mal is joining the Territorials, there is no longer a conscription law. But remember, he's 5 years older than the Beatles.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
So when he turned 18, you know, that would have been 53. So, different time.
Ken, was there any regret on Mal's part to kind of what Lennon went through at the height of Beatlemania, not being there for his son? Like, these guys are taking off, and I've got a family, but, you know, I've got to follow and do this. Does he have any moments of that, you know, leaving Lily and Gary behind?
I think undoubtedly. You know, I obviously go into specifics in the book at great length. I mean, in many ways, that's the story that a person like Mal and all of us would face in that situation, you know. Here you are with this incredible phenomenon, right? That we're still trying to understand today. And on the one side of the ledger, you have that experience, which is an outlier, right? There's nothing else like that. And then on the other hand, you know, you want to be a good father and husband. And Mal really did feel like he could do it all. But what he found out, like all of us, is that he couldn't. So I'm sure there were deep regrets there. I mean, I know there were. He's written about it. But would he change it? I don't think so. I think in a lot of ways, that's the story, right? You know, so when you have something that seductive, right? I mean, imagine the bird's eye or bird's ear view that he had, spending all of that time in the studio, more than anyone, maybe more than George Martin with them at a certain level, right? Mm-hmm. And listening to the music go from, I guess the first full album he would have experienced would have been with the Beatles, right? Going on through to the end of Abbey Road. It's remarkable for us just to listen to it as consumers of that great music. Imagine what it would have been like to be in that room, right? Mm-hmm. And to watch them before your eyes in such a tight period of time, right? I've already been working on this now for half the time that they were recording artists.
Wow.
Right.
And, you know, this is pretty new to me. I mean, other than I knew about Mal before, right? Like all of us. But
no, you're working on it 3.5 years, and they were recording artists for 7.5, 8. So yeah,
really, just yeah, and that's generous, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's really quite remarkable what he must have experienced, and I don't know how. You know, it's like watching the greatest TV series unfold before your eyes. How do you look away? I don't know. And that's not even talking about all the other excitement and glitz of stardom, but, you know, it was intoxicating for him to watch.
I love how they, you know, every once in a while they throw him a bone. If you look on the back of Rubber Soul, you look at the song You Won't See Me, he's credited as Mal Organ Evans. And then I think it's just Organ Evans on the U.S. Rubber Soul. Kind of interesting how every once in a while, you know, at least if you're a kid in the U.S. and you're looking at these credits and you're like, who the hell is Mal Evans? Why is he credited? Good stuff.
Ken, tell us if you can a little bit about the 65 Chicago tour disaster and Mal's role in that.
Do you mean the American tour?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, that to me was
65 shows. Yeah.
The 65 shows. Yeah. I've been really fascinated. You know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about those concert tours. I don't know that I had as deep a sense of the level of tension and violence that there was in 1965. You know, we've always known there's this kind of dark side of Beatlemania, right? We've seen it come out in some terrible ways at Friar Park and in an archway in 1980. But there just is this undercurrent, especially, and it really manifested in 65. And while there were different kinds of tensions in 66, the level of stress and violence that Mal faced in 65 is really incredible. You know, he lost a tonnage of weight just dealing with trying to keep people safe. And that didn't just include the Beatles. It included the fans. I mean, there were times, the Cow Palace is such a notable example where afterwards it's like a war zone. You know, people are, they're almost conducting triage to help people out, you know, after the shows. So that, and certainly we can't forget the Down Under tour in the summer of 64, right? When they go to New Zealand and Australia. Mm-hmm. I mean, the crowds there dwarfed the ones around the rest of the world. I mean, there were times when Mal, there was one scene where they had to go 30 feet into an underground garage, and there were too many people, and the people weren't leaving. And eventually, Mal climbed out of the limo and stood in front of the car, and it took like 40 minutes to go those feet as Mal pushed everybody out of the way until they finally could shoot into the garage. You know? And of course, that would leave a lot of bruises, right?
Yeah.
scenes like that. And of course, looking at it from our vantage point in the 21st century, all we can think is, well, you needed more guys, right? There are
absolutely
a lot of
interesting
stories where Mal would deal with the police, and these police chiefs in major cities, you know, would be like, yeah, we'll send a couple of officers over. And Mal would be like, right, that is not going to be enough.
It's surprising that their entourage isn't 30, 40, 50 people, you know, during these tours. I mean, you said, I mean, Mal had to have been under a lot of stress to have been, you know, responsible for this undertaking.
Sure. And they knew it. It's not like they didn't recognize it. It's just, I find this, and this is another interesting part about the work that we all do, right? You talk to folks from that era, and you eventually conclude that they're all inventing their jobs, right? Whether you're Tony King or Brian Epstein or Mal and Neil, you're making up your job. You're being a pioneer. It's on the job training where there is no manual,
right?
You know, and it's endlessly fascinating to study how they're making up their jobs as they go along, trying to figure out what it is, you know. And at first, they thought, remember, you know, George Harrison's famous line, I guess I'm not a Beatle anymore, right, when the touring ended. And yet, they were only just getting started, as we know. Their jobs were about to manifest in more hours.
Right. Now, did Mal feel the same way that Brian felt once the touring stopped? Because we know Brian felt, well, I'm useless now because they're not touring. Did Mal feel the same way, or Mal was just like, okay, I'm going to do whatever you need me to do. If we're in the studio, I'll get you tea, or I'll get you guitars. Like, once touring ended, how did Mal take that? Because he had done so much, as you mentioned, you know, getting through 64, and particularly 65 and the end of 66 when they wrap up.
So getting a straight answer on this one's pretty tough. I have no evidence that Mal ever thought, well, I guess the job's over, like, you know, like others may have said.
Right.
I think he understood their ambitions as artists very, very well. You never read or see that kind of stress for him. It's after the touring years when he moves his family down to London and they buy a house, right? So I think that we can take that evidence and understand that Mal really felt plugged into what they were trying to do and understood it. And understood that the future was in the studio, just as they did, right?
Right, right.
This is where I get a little frustrated with the memories of folks. Like Paul saying, you know, we decided right there in the armored car, we weren't touring.
Yeah.
That's just factual. And they had to have had some notions about this. They'd stopped touring Britain in December 65. They had told Brian they weren't doing that anymore. They knew why. And so Mal understood why and was eager and ready to be a part of that, wherever that was going to take them. And of course, they had no idea that it was going to take them into immortality, right? Brian's problem, though, is, of course, those latter tours were very difficult for him. He had scandal attached to his name and couldn't really see his value outside of that part of the business, which is a shame because we know that Brian was terribly smart about managing their business. And he would be a very tough negotiator and protect them in many great ways that had nothing to do with concerts or touring or promotion. So it is a shame that he couldn't see that, but he had never connected in the studio, right? Like maybe Mal and Neil did. So he really felt like that's where the boys carried out this different part of the business. But of course, you know, flying up 40,000 feet above this whole story, they began in a music business where, you know, the record companies made the records and would reap almost all the profits. You would go out on the road as the band, right? And if there were a band with you two guys, I would see it. You guys go out on the road. That's where you're seeing your money, right? And of course, there were still professional songwriters and producers and A&R guys and all of these folks who had very heavy-handed roles in the trajectory of a career. So, you know, the Beatles just were blowing that up faster than anyone could even comprehend or interpret what was happening. But Brian couldn't see that, you know, at times.
No.
Although Brian, of course, was magnificent in other ways, right? You know, saying that the children of the 21st century are going to be listening to this music. So he certainly understood its impact. But it's just fascinating the team they had around them. You know, obviously you could not have had better people, because if you throw in Mal, Neil, George Martin, and Brian, you know, those are eight people then who upended an entire industry and just pushed it over. Pretty easily too. I've been working on a project as a supplement to my classes this last couple of weeks, and it has required me to go in and study the level of their penetration in the British charts. It's pretty staggering how they're often replacing themselves as the number one album. But their ability to penetrate those charts and just control the conversation, which, by the way, they should be. Their music is the music that we're talking about and we'll talk about for centuries. Mm-hmm. Their ability to do that is staggering. The level of, like, you know, the famous quote from John Lennon, "We were in the crow's nest." Yeah, on the ship. That's certainly where they were, if not higher. Maybe they were already on shore, you know, on the next boat. It's amazing.
Well, it's just fascinating to see how one person takes the reaction to the stopping of the touring. And then now you say Mal moves his family down to London and says, okay, we're here and we're going to just soldier on to this next journey, no matter what it is. If it's whatever I need to do, history looks like it's shown us that he was not perturbed by the stop, you know, the touring ending, which is pretty cool, because considering Brian's story is so well told that, you know, they just looked at it two totally different ways. But both such key people to the Beatles story. And they just went in different ways with it.
Sure. And Mal loved people. It was, and he understood this. It was his great secret weapon. So they could go to Tokyo, you know, I guess the exception is Manila. But wherever they went, Mal negotiated, you know, India. Sure. He's never been there. So what, you know, he didn't have a passport until the Beatles came along. Right. So, they just, he was supremely confident. He had good emotional intelligence. So he was very good at meeting people. He would be the one, you know, he would come back to England with dozens of new pen pals, you know, people to keep in touch with, and he would write the letters, you know. Oh. So he just had a natural gift for that. You have to wonder what would have happened if he'd had a company that he ran with some kind of high touch aspect to it. He might have been a billionaire. He's just very, very good at remembering names, you know. He could do a lot of things that the Beatles and the others couldn't. He just had that natural sense about it. Neil wanted nothing to do with that, right? You know, Neil had other skills that complemented Mal very well, and they knew it. They were good cop and bad cop a lot. They knew how to play. They knew their roles really inside and out.
Interesting. So you talk about traveling. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, Paul and Mel. Is the Africa trip the first time they go on vacation together? And did he write anything about that?
He writes hundreds of pages about that. You know, they had traveled before, but that was when they had an extended moment. John was making How I Won the War, right? They just left the touring world. Paul and Mal were often tourists together. You know, they would, whether it was on one of that last European tour or Tokyo or what have you, Mal and Neil would be the ones who'd go see the sites. And so they had almost a routine together. There's a great moment that Mal writes about in his diary where he stayed up all night partying, and there were no Beatles. It was just him. The Beatles were all in bed. You know, he was just stayed up. It was in Europe somewhere. And he is just walking, you know, he's just knackered. He's drunk and he's walking back to his room, and there's Paul. He's up at like 7. He's like, let's go see Rome or wherever, you know, I'm ready. And of course, Mal didn't say no. Mal would be like, yeah, you're right. Let's go see Rome. And that would be it. Cool.
Very interesting.
Andy? With the traveling too, I mean, a little bit before that, was George's retelling of the Manila trip spot on accurate with the, you know, they wouldn't let him off the plane until they called Mal and he had to hand over cash from the Manila tour? George recounts that story in the anthology. Does Mal talk about that in his diaries, leaving Manila after that experience?
Yeah, and they got beat up pretty badly. Brian Epstein was really badly hurt. There were a couple times Brian got pretty badly hurt. I think another time he fell off the back of an airplane when they were trying to get out the back entrance. that may have been in my hometown of Houston, if I'm not mistaken. But they were all pretty beaten up pretty badly. And Mal really thought he was going to be executed because he had been pretty, you know, when they were trying to get to their plane, Mal had been pretty forceful with people, you know, trying to get out there. And it was clear that they meant business, that this was, you know, this wasn't just for show. They were really hitting them pretty hard.
Wow. Mm. Incredible.
He thought it was over.
He did.
You know, sure.
So, you know, tell Lil I love her.
Wasn't the only time he said that either, but it was, he really, he meant it. You know, George Harrison had famous fear of flying and travel, and he and Mal could really rev each other up on their sort of dire preparation for the day that one of their planes went down. Right.
Right.
But after events like that in 66, Mal didn't have any fears. I doubt George did either. I mean, after that, you survived that.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, right? So you're surviving that, and you move forward to when Klein comes. Klein, how does he stay out of Klein's cross? He's like, hey, look, I survived Manila, man. I don't care what you know. But it's interesting how he did survive the Klein's crosshairs, you know. And was Mal a total, like, Mal and Neil were like, look, you can't touch us, man. You can do whatever else you want, but you ain't touching us. Is, you know, can you tell us a little bit about how Mal stayed, or Mal's relationship with Klein, or the lack thereof, and how he stayed out of the crosshairs?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a big part of the book that you'll have to wait to read, my friend. But
just give us a little tease.
What's wonderful about that is, you know, and if we're ever going to be fired, I think we want to be able to have the experience they did, right? Where they could say, well, that's great, but you can't fire them. Because they didn't work for Apple, for Beatles and company. So they weren't employees of, they were the only two employees of Beatles and company, right? Other than the four Beatles. So they were part of that team, and they couldn't be fired. But unfortunately, Alan can do a lot of things that were worse than firing them. So, you know, Mal and Neil would both have a lot of scars from working with Alan and dealing with him, and the challenges therein. I mean, you know, he could run the conversation in his role, and did for several years there, on what they could and couldn't do. I know from the depositions that he was extremely concerned about Neil, because he'd been with them so long. So Alan was threatened. You know, these were two very resourceful guys. You know, Mal wants to make himself into a record producer. He has a top five hit. You know, these are not, you know, and I spoke to Joey a few weeks ago, Joey Mullen. He was telling me about how Mal took charge on the studio floor. He just said, here's what I want you to do. It wasn't the Mal that he knew before, which was the guy who's sort of, you know, a big teddy bear. Suddenly he was like, here's how we're going to arrange this. Here's what I want you to do. You know, it was really, he said he got really
confident. He got confident in his abilities for sure.
Yeah. But they both, you know, both Neil and Mal could do this. They could, they had to be, you know, cause there was a lot of risk. It's a wonder, right, that they don't leave the 60s with more shadows on their record. I mean, you know, you got the Bigger Than Jesus thing, which was a self-inflicted wound. You have the, it shouldn't have happened. You have the, what else do we have? We've got, we have Manila, you know, any number of things.
Didn't they escape some, was it Minnesota? They got, you know, Paul, I mean, I guess the after party or an after there during the tour, was it 64, 65, where the police officer, you can see him on the Beatles anthology, said if they never came back or if I never heard the Beatles again, it'd be too soon. I heard they supposedly got into some kind of trouble with maybe Paul with a younger, with an underage woman that could, or girl that could have got them into some serious trouble.
Yeah, so that one ended up being Much Ado About Nothing. I mean, they had a party in their suite. By this point, the parties are starting to morph into less raucous affairs, simply because they're worn out, you know. But yeah, Minneapolis on its face looks to be a disaster in the making. It turned out that... And I think our friend Chuck Gunderson has some really good material on this in his book. Turns out that another party was occurring in the building and they were blaming it on the Beatles. And so Mal was very vigilant that night and trying to explain, no, they're not going to our floor. But that guy was, he was disgusted that they were in town, probably did not like the new music. you might say, I don't know that that was, I don't believe that it was the story at all. I think that was actually Much Ado About Nothing. That, cool. But it, I mean, right. When it was happening, it was ugly, you know, and that of course, think about the kinds of liability they skirted during those days. And this is where, you know, they were crazy and remiss. All sorts of things could have gone wrong, right? With fans. It's amazing no one died, right? At any of those events. It's incredible the level of liability that existed. And that's why you don't just have two guys, right? So to the folks out there, when you go on tour, right, there's a reason why you want more folks working with and for you because,
right.
You know, people thinking about liability. Now, Mal would do that. Mal and had written several times, you know, I think about how I can protect the boys, but he was really making it up as he went along. It right. just turns yeah. out he was making it up for the most part pretty well. Right. But, you know, I mean, today, you know, thousands of books have been written about liability and security and those sorts of things. They were, again, they were inventing these careers.
Well, and, you know, look at it now, right? Tours, musicians travel with hundreds, if not a team of a thousand to produce a concert and a tour. And here's Mal and Neil and maybe Derek, Tony Barrow or Derek Taylor, maybe going with them. I mean, just while the four of them are touring. So you make a good point of inventing his job as he's going along with it, because it's literally, you know, okay, we need this. Okay, we're going to go do it. I mean, for those four guys in the mid 60s,
but it wasn't just those four guys. So on those mid-60s, certainly in 65 and 66, they had many other acts on the bill.
Right.
Sometimes there would be one other roadie, but Mal would be setting up their equipment too. Because really? He learned early on that the best way he could protect the boys for their show at 9 p.m. or whenever, right? After the other four acts have gone on, like The Circle and Sounds Incorporated, that the best way he could protect them would be to make sure he set up the other equipment, right? Because if he sets it up correctly, it can come off correctly, and he can then move their equipment on correctly. You know, so that certainly was smart of him, but I'm sure it was just one more thing that was wearing him out.
Yeah.
Okay.
To go through that.
Right.
Post breakup, and you mentioned.
Well, one more thing, real quick here, Andy, about the while the band's still together.
All right.
Paul's wedding. Wasn't necessarily supposed. Well, I mean, was he the best man? Wasn't necessarily supposed to be the best man. I think Mike was supposed to be there. He couldn't make it, so Mel steps in. Is that the story?
It's sort of true, but I talked to Mike McCartney about that, and he had been delayed on doing a gig of his own of some kind. It may have been PR. I don't think it was a performance with the scaffold or anything. Mm. And when he was coming down to London, he just kept getting delayed. And, you know, Paul actually, they waited till Mike showed up before they finished. That's why they were there so long. So Mal wasn't really as big. Mike was the best man, and Mike fulfilled that role. But Mal was the one keeping everybody at bay. And Mike suggested to me that it was, that Mal had done him a great service by sort of, you know, I think Peter Brown was there. Is that correct? And making sure that space was preserved for him. And Paul, to his credit, you know, waited for his brother. He was a good brother that day and waited for Mike to get there. I find nothing funnier than looking at that photo of Paul and Mal and Linda looking great. And Heather's there, mm-hmm. right outside of Cavendish Avenue when they've come home. And here are all these apple scruffs, right? And some of them like the baby that they're babysitting for their day job when they're not following the Beatles. And you just look at Linda and you have to think, what was she thinking? What am I getting into here? There's this whole strange apparatus that exists that, you know, is all about this. It's, fascinating.
Yeah. So you mentioned at the start that Paul's relationship with Mal was one of the strongest ones within the four of them throughout with the group's tenure. But post-breakup, it seems like Mal certainly is in the John, George, Ringo camp in terms of the early solo stuff. You know, he's helping George on All Things Must Pass and stuff like that. And it just seems that initially, it's interesting. He was very close to Paul during the 60s, at the height of the Beatles. Paul distances himself, obviously, goes to Scotland. So that changes things. And I just wondered if that, you know, impacted his relationship with Paul moving forward, you know, as, you know, towards the end of his life.
Sure. So Paul had created a schism, right? We all know this. And eventually he is suing in high court, the other three, to end the partnership. And, you know, for a good while, Mal helped Paul secretly. In fact, Neil didn't know.
Oh, wow.
Kind of a funny. Yeah. And it got a little testy because he didn't want to betray Paul. But ultimately, the schism went the way that the schism was going to go, which was the other three are in a defensive position and Paul is working to end the partnership. And Mal, I think, kind of naturally gravitates to that other side. I mean, it's not like he wasn't taking sides. He was just working with the folks who needed the help and were asking for it. You know, Paul is kind of carving his own pathway, right? Yeah, and Mal understood that. You know, he would write, Paul is bravely going it alone to try to make his career work. And, you know, occasionally he would call on Mal, but Mal spent, you know, Mal worked with the others, you know, right up to the mid-1970s on their solo records, you know. So he was very engaged in their projects. I think his last Ringo project was Goodnight Vienna.
Hmm.
Right.
Hmm. Without
speaking of that, then, okay, go ahead.
No, I was going to follow up. Without giving it too much away, does the, you know, the partnership dissolving, does it put Mal into a bad funk period, and like, you know, like that Paul went through? Does he go through a period of like, what the hell am I going to do now? You know, without giving too much away.
Yeah. Oh, don't worry. I'm not giving anything away. I'm being very deft here. But, come on. You know me. It is interesting. You know, that's an interesting question. And I find the four of them five of them, including Mal, Neil's having a tough early 1970s. He really had gone through the ringer. But I'm always impressed with how resourceful they are, right? I mean, you've been in the biggest band of all time. You know it, right? It's not like you and your friends just think you were in the big. You were in mm-hmm. the biggest, you know, pop musical enterprise of all time, and you know, it would be so easy to just go hide away, right, for several years, like Clapton, or what have you. I mean,
yeah,
they don't do this at all. I mean, there's just something magic in their workmanlike chemistry where, I mean, look at how they all come out of the gate creating so much material, right? When you start studying, particularly through the mid-70s and even beyond a bit, right? Just how still dominant they are, even outside of the structure of being a Beatle. I find it amazing. And Mal had some of that in him. So when, you know, when they got to the point where they're just going about their business, Mal's right there with them. You need help on Imagine? Okay. Plastic Ono. Oh, we're doing that now. Okay. And Mal would be there, you know, he would help. They had all those Apple artists. You know, one of the interesting things is at a certain point, the people working the most with the Apple artists are just Mal and George. Paul sort of goes the other way, as one might understand.
Yep.
You know, that was not necessarily John or Ringo's interest. It's really George and Mal. They're finding new acts. They're nurturing acts. Splinter, you know, they spent hundreds and thousands of hours with Splinter and Badfinger nurturing these groups. And it was because George and Mal liked it. They liked doing that.
You know what? It was left because John had gone to New York. Paul was doing his thing. So it was just Mal and George to kind of right the ship there and keep the stable going.
Yeah. And of course, one thing Alan was doing for a while very effectively was siphoning off their ability to bring on new talent, you know, because if they had their druthers, I think George and Mal to his own extent would have continued to do that. They really believed in the Apple model. And when you look at the just wide range, particularly with George that he works with, it's incredible. But Mal would be, you know, writing letters for Apple to the artists. He would be running up to meet them and go hear their performances. You know, they were, the two of them were like a couple of great coaches in a lot of ways, right? Yeah, they really were. They just loved being in it to try to help people. And they're just, I can't wait to show the world all the photos we have of them from this time. Just two of them, especially the two of them, just, you could really tell that they were big pals. And they just, I wish we had more of a record of the conversations they must have had about Doris Troy and Billy Preston and Lon and Derek Van Eaton and Splinter and, you know, all of those different, and certainly, you know, the Ivies morphing into Badfinger and what to do about it. But this is sort of what I meant earlier. So until they got rid of him, Alan could control a lot of this conversation, you know. Mm. He could control what would be released, when it would be released. You know, he could exert a lot of power in those discussions. And so that had to be deeply frustrating.
Right. Do we know how much Mal had to do with the You and Me, Babe song? I mean, did he contribute to that song? Was it just lyrics? Was it music ideas?
I think you'll be pleased to know it was Mal's song. George helped out on his.
Oh, wow.
It predated. Okay. Comparison. Yeah, Mal has thousands of sets of lyrics and musical ideas that he preserved. And You and Me, Babe had gone back a couple of years that he'd been working on that. And so it was George who helped him finish the music when they were in the studio. And that's an interesting, very interesting stage management of that album. I have all of Mal's notes on that record. And it's just extremely interesting to read. And you can see how Ringo really wanted that band back together, didn't he? Oof. He really, really did. And as soon as he realized that he had just had a session and it was making the news with himself and John and George and Klaus, right? He he got on a plane and went, Mal went with him to Apple Studios, and that's when they worked with Paul and Linda. I mean, he just was not going to allow the story to go out that way without Paul getting a chance to be on the record. It's really impressive. Right.
Yeah.
Very impressive stuff. When they jet off to England, then they come back and actually at that point they hadn't made You and Me, Babe. They come back and Ringo needs a song to create a farewell, and
the 6 o'clock, the 6 o'clock song.
Six o'clock is McCartney. No, You and Me, Babe. Yeah,
right.
And Bill Schnee, who was the engineer, told me about how they came back to finish that, and Mal had most of it written. And but you know, George started playing that kind of funky mid-70s kind of guitar bit, you know, if you can count it up in your head, and because it kind of starts subtly and it builds up, and then Ringo has his big, you know, I want to thank this person and this person.
right. Did Mal do many interviews, especially after the fact, after the breakup?
There must be more than I've been able to dig up, but I can count. There are about maybe 10 or so, including a good half of those are on audio cassette. Mal kept a lot of cassettes of his own work, so we have that, you know, and his own ideas.
Wow.
Yeah, he was fortunately in the last weeks of his life, and he met up with a DJ in California at Cal State Northridge, and Mal did an interview. And so he actually gives away some of the things that were going on in his life at the time. So it really helped to date where and when he was in his thinking.
Wow. Interesting. Ken, did he do any work on Neil's Long and Winding Road documentary? Or was that just all Neil's?
Yeah, no, it was them together.
Okay.
In fact, it had the name of Scrapbook. They called it Scrapbook.
Right.
And every now and then they would be in Apple together. And one of the secretaries there told me about how they would say, we're going to go get out Scrapbook now. And that was what they called the project that would become the Long and Winding Road. And they just loved it. It was this nostalgia trip for both of them. You know, here they are in these vulnerable positions after the breakup. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously Mal is working like a maniac, driving around, going to the different projects as they're taking place, particularly around 71 and 72. But they called it Scrapbook, and then it became Long and Winding Road. Obviously Neil would come back to it occasionally, but Mal was deeply involved in that. That was their thing together. There's a really moving moment. I finally got the recording of Mal's talk at Beatles Fest in 1975, in the fall of 75. Oh, cool. And somebody said, what about Neil? And Mal just said, he's my best mate.
Yeah, you played it. Didn't you play a little bit of that snippet? Yeah, you played
I love that because it just tells you how deep that bond was.
Oh. That's a golden
75 when Apple has finally been, you know, Apple ends in January of 75, you know, after it's gone through the courts and after the signatures at the end of 74, they decide to rev it up again. And Mal and Neil comes out to see Mal to talk about what are we going to do next?
Yeah, because he was still being obviously paid, you know, through Apple through all that time.
Right, but now it was time to, and there were several moments like this. Ken Mansfield had one at one point where they were going to try to revivify Apple with his group. This is after Mal was gone. Just different moments where, you know, they really believed in the dream, right? The idea of creating a world where artists would have a fair shake. And actually, as Tony Bramwell said, you know, you want to see someone who has disgust for Alan Klein, it's Tony, because he would sit and say, Alan, you bought into this thing that were this big money losing right enterprise. And he got a lot of that from John Lennon. Right. And Tony would say, look at the balance sheet, Apple Publishing is a mint. You are minting money with Apple Publishing, and Alan just wouldn't listen. You know, he was they were creating such wealth. You know, when you think about the artists, including that one called the Beatles, right? Yeah. They're creating incredible publishing wealth, and their catalog was wealthy. You know, when you look at especially those early levels of success that weren't just Beatles.
Mm. Right.
Can you talk a little bit about the last few days of his life and maybe why he reacted? I mean, because when the story I heard, I mean, the cops are barging in and I don't know. I mean, I want to know more about that. I mean, is he retaliating against the police? I mean, is he cooperating? What's that story?
I mean, what is that story? You know, I think, how do I say this without Mal wanted to die. He did not want to live any longer. And that's how that day ended up. There was, you know,
cause it's, you know, you could see if he felt that way in the, you know, first couple of years of the breakup, you know, somebody who was so reliant upon the Beatles as a group, but no, Mal, you know, perseveres, you know, he works with all of them still, mainly, you know, mainly George. And so you get through the first half of the 70s and then some tragic, stupid thing like that happens. And it's just the time you would have expected something. If that was going to happen, it would have happened sooner, like earlier. It happen in 76 is crazy.
Mal's demise had nothing to do with the Beatles. You know, it wasn't related to them or anything like that. It was all of it was self-inflicted. Mal would never have hurt the police. You know, he did not want to live after January 4th, 1976, but he would never have hurt the police.
No.
Okay. Well, I got one last thing too. So then after the death, I mean, was it Lily who tried to auction off his belongings? And story I heard was Paul blocked this from happening?
So that's you're going forward decades.
Yeah, that's later. Later.
Yeah, I can't comment on that other than to say that that both parties ended up finding their better angels. There's a long story there that has I think a happy ending as much as it can have one. You know, for the longest time, Lily didn't even have any of the belongings. So, in fact, my favorite part of the whole story is just tracing this stuff as it moves around the country and the world. Mm-hmm. And I talked to people who worked as, you know, junior office boys and really gotten the story of Mal's stuff and where it was and how it got there. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's the most interesting part of the mystery. It involves the after Mal, right? I mean, even his ashes, as you know, were famously lost. They were on a shelf at Heathrow. So you always got to check the shelf at the airport. See, I think that's a good thing to remember, but it's, you know, at the end of it, it's really a story about, you know, what we do in our lives and how we put so much of ourselves, maybe more than we should be, into different kinds of, I don't know how to put it, enterprises and activities and how, you know, and how seductive it is. And Mal could not turn away, you know, he just couldn't. And, you know, at one point he says the Beatles are better than food or drink.
He loved them until his dying day. That's it.
Yeah, sure. And, I do think we owe him a tremendous debt, because in every story, there are the other people, right, who are helping to make something possible. Mal's the reason that if it got to be 2 a.m. and, you know, after a while you just want to go home, Mal could make some beans and toast. Or if the guitar string broke, he knows the guy at, you know, downtown who can get him some new strings in the middle of the night. Mal has his number. You know, Mal is why they could extend those sessions. You know, if it were left to any of us, we'd be like, you know what, we really seem to have something great going on with this new tune. I don't know, happiness is a warm gun or whatever, but why don't we just go home? You know, Mal enabled them to extend themselves. And I mean, in a lot of ways, he kind of mothered them, right? You know, I mean, he, you know, and he would, he and Neil, and they knew this, they would take the blows. You know, they were more than happy to be the ones that got yelled at.
Yep.
They would take the abuse if it meant that they could get a few more hours of work done. Because at some point, these guys figure out that something is happening with them that is bigger than they are. Right?
Yeah.
That's more important and bigger than being 26 and living in London, right? And having wealth at your fingertips, that, you know, something bigger is happening with the kinds of music you're making. You know, I mean, when you look at those, particularly from in the studio years, just the quantity and the profundity of that music and the stories and the characters, it's Shakespeare, you know, and there's just something magical where they put aside, as best they can, they don't always succeed, but they put aside ego, they put aside their own concerns, and they come back to the center to keep making that music. You know, as long and as far as they could take it, they did.
Yeah.
Andy, so powerful, you know.
Very, very powerful. It's going to be, no, I have no other questions. It's going to be a great book. Yeah. It comes out in November. Living the Beatles Legend, The Untold Story of Mal Evans, written by our friend Ken Womack. And man, we were just a little bit of a sample and a tasting here, but boy, you have been working on it for 3.5 years, and this is, yeah.
Well, it's not over yet, really, because then what, after this book, then next year, or right, we've got the diary that's actually going to get published as well?
Yeah, and that this is, I'm really excited about that. I've got it really going well so far, but I may have to test it on you guys when it's ready to be seen. It's what I want it to be is, okay, we've told Mal's story now. After November, here it is. Draw your own conclusions. Here is all of this collection of facts, new interviews, you know, a good 100 of them I conducted, you know, if not more. Here's the story. Now, the next book, though, is going to be the DIY book. It'll be the book where you have all the diaries. You have all the notebooks. You have, there are notebooks where he's just writing thoughts. I can imagine scenarios where other folks who love thinking about this band run down their own rabbit holes and discover, hey, wait a minute, who's that guy on page 95 of Mal's 1975 notebook? I want to know more about that. Or, you know, why is Mal speaking in code here about something, right? There'll even be a little bit of fun for folks to, you'll start noticing when you study the diaries that every now and then different handwriting shows up. Could it be from those famous four guys? Well, yeah, you know, so it's interesting to see what they're underscoring at times, right? It's so I'm excited that this will then become you know, a kind of DIY project for others who want to study Mal's extant writings within the context of his photographs and his drawings. I think that's fun, you know, that'll be fun for people. And they'll make discoveries that I didn't think of, I guarantee it.
There's just when you think the final word has been said on something Beatles related, we've got something else. And that's,
well, it won't be, it will never be. It's, you know, it's like Shakespeare, you know, I know from my academic life, just how deep the study of Shakespeare or James Joyce, right? Or hell, Harry Potter, right? This whole universe, right? The Beatles is a universe. And it, you know, when you start wanting to understand where a chord progression came from, or how these ideas were generated, it's just endlessly fascinating. You know, it absolutely is. And as technology improves, I mean, I don't have much use for these AI things where I just don't see the value to me in simulating pulse. Imagine. I don't care about
no.
that.
Nope.
No.
I want things that are grounded in reality. But imagine, pun intended, I guess. Imagine when our technology, and we saw it with Giles Martin, right? With Revolver, and I guess Peter Jackson's team, being able to disaggregate those sounds. You can learn a lot from a guitar part, you know, right. A drum part. You know, when you're able to pull those pieces aside, you hear different things. I have a mix of Martha My Dear where, you know, it's all doing his backing vocals, and you can hear all this magic taking place. He's tapping his foot. He's humming. He's kind of bumping a music stand. You know, you're in the studio at that point. And I think those kinds of things are endlessly fascinating. And as technology gets better, you know, there will be a world where you can disaggregate the tracks on Please Please Me, right?
Yep.
All right. Hear it. Well, and that's coming.
Yeah. And maybe sooner than we think. But, you know, I'm excited about that. I want to follow, you know, I want to listen to George Harrison's guitar solos on those earliest recordings and trace them all the way up to the sublime moments of Something and Here Comes the Sun.
Sure.
Excellent. Well, the book is Living the Beatles Legend, The Untold Story of Mel Evans. The author is Ken Womack. Ken, it's been a pleasure to have you back on. You can tell anybody about any social media that you want, they can follow you on, or any other upcoming projects that you might have in the pipeline.
Appearances. So
take it away.
Sure. I'm appearing this weekend, and you both are welcome to come for free as my guest.
Thank you.
And I know one of you could really do this.
Yes.
Speaking on Saturday night, I happen to be president in my spare time, which doesn't exist, of the Garden State Philharmonic, and we're doing Bach to the Beatles on Saturday night the Grunin Center, just down the parkway from you, Andy.
Yes, sir.
So I'm doing that. I'll make a few remarks ahead about why there is a pathway from Bach to the Beatles, right? That's a real music tradition. Doing things like that.
Where is that at, Ken?
It's at Ocean County College.
Okay.
OCC.
Yes, sir.
7 o'clock, I'm speaking. Always good to see my friend Andy.
Writing it down right now.
And Tom, you know how to get on a plane.
Oh, I do.
Maybe not at this short term, but anyway, so that... Right. Other than that, though, I'm just doing a lot of writing, and folks can follow me on my website. Has a newsletter where we try to keep people up to date on what I'm doing. As you guys know, I do my books and my record clubs, which is great fun. Yeah. We're kicking it off. I cannot believe that our 8th season of Tuesday Night Record Club starts next week on Tuesday night. Wow. It's free, the best price, and it's the Cars debut album. What a record. Yes.
Okay.
Amazing.
And you've got your podcast, right? Everything Fab Four as well.
I do. Yeah. Just that's right. I just talked to Billy Bob Thornton in the Boxmasters.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Excellent. But
this is where I go for my Paul McCartney information right here. You are the two
very good. Very good.
You're the two legs who handle that.
Thank you.
One and two. And of course you'll be at the fest. Two. You'll be at the fest in Chicago, right?
Oh, you bet. And then I'll be at JFK.
Yes. Yep. 60th anniversary for the Beatles coming to America. 50th anniversary of the Fest for Beatles fans. What a crazy, crazy time. Andy, anything you want to plug?
All quiet on that. Just we're busy with the two leggers and all things Beatles and McCartney right now.
Right. And I just started, I don't know how or when I'm going to get the time to do more of this, but I just started my movie channel called Tom's Movie Channel. Simple enough. And that's on YouTube. You can find it again, Tom's Movie Channel. The link will be down below in the description. Just posted my first episode on Mean Streets from 1973, and hopefully we'll have another episode either tonight or, well, I guess we're talking in the past here when this episode gets posted.
Yes.
So, but hopefully there'll be plenty of new episodes up by the time this is posted. So, Ken Womack, again,
congrats, thank you. Bob. That's cool. Yeah.
Yes, thank you very much. And Ken Womack, again, you've been excellent. Thank you very much for telling us what you can about this much anticipated book. Andy, my friend, always great to see you, and we'll be seeing you soon on here and your other channel. And I'm Tom Hunyadi, and as always, have a great day and a beautiful night. Take care.
See you, people.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan.